The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, I'm Kurt Benrud with the North Carolina Reading Service. Welcome to Sci-Fi. For the next 30 minutes, we'll be reading to you from Daily Sci-Fi.
I'm Mike Rumble. This is The Coffee Pot by Jez Patterson. "Don't you ever sleep?" she asked, and he shook his head. "No," she thought. "He never will, and he's going to keep you here forever, in this soft, white bed, like some fairy princess." He was a thing of black moods, black shadows, black smudges, as if the thick, greasy coffee he brewed were seeping out of his skin like oil through cotton. It circled his eyes, had pulled sooty thumbs down his cheeks. He could have been camouflaged for a midnight raid. He smoked thin cigars, wincing as if he were not really a smoker at all, but was being punished by being forced to finish the packet. The cigars resembled sticks of licorice. Their ends didn't so much smolder as unravel with threads of the same mucky ingredients. He scared her. She kept the sheets held up to her chin whilst he sat at the foot of her bed, a small table beside him for his coffee cup, and a glass ashtray full of tiny spent butts. "Aren't you tired?" she asked carefully, not wanting to antagonize him. He didn't answer, but the subtle recreasing around his eyes told her that, yes, he was so, so tired, that it was the coffee, the cigars alone, that kept him awake, and that his willpower had long ago petered out. "If he sleeps," she thought, "then I can get out of here." She considered asking him why he was doing this, what she'd done to hurt or provoke him, and it wasn't just fear that stopped her. It was the fact that if his mind became occupied, if she engaged him in conversation, then he was even less likely to succumb to sleep's finger-bending invitation to join it. All the time, trying to stay awake. "Aren't your eyelids heavy? Can't you feel your shoulders hanging lower?" She chose smooth, soft, soothing tones to imitate the turn of a moonlight tide, or the swell and swirl of the voice one heard in the womb. "I bet even your fingers and toes feel soft and drooping." She pictured them like warmed wax, and voiced the image to him. He listened, not interrupting, not resisting, and she watched the bruised eyelids slide halfway down so he looked dopey, drugged. The whites were bloodshot, the veins slowly filling the space between as if a child's pencil scribbled them in. The current cigar and coffee were finished, so his hands were momentarily empty. Had they not been, the cup might have dropped, the cigar butt burned his fingers. It was the perfect time, and so she kept up her slow, deliberate litany. "No," he said. "Mustn't sleep. Got to stay awake. For you." "I'll be okay," she said, leaning up in the bed. His head rocked back, to the side, each time requiring more effort to wrench it upright again. It rolled in half circles now, the battle lost, like he was mimicking the slow churn before the plug hole claimed him entirely. "Don't understand. You." "No," she thought, "you won't hold me here anymore." His eyes closed entirely, snipping the elastic in his cheeks so they hung slack. She felt a tingle sink towards her toes as something effervescent spread up and down her body from a point in her midriff. She pulled a hand from under the covers and looked straight through its disappearing substance. "No," she said, but her voice was sand-tipped from a shoe. "No, you've got to wake up, Keith. Wake up and keep me here. Open your eyes and see me. I can't stay if you sleep. I..." The bed lay empty, the husband breathing raggedly, but regularly in the chair.
My name is Mary Mason, reading Casting Call by Alexandra Grunberg. I'm sorry, I just don't think you're right for the part. Michael Pokesy shuffled the resume in front of him to the bottom of a large pile of resumes, the result of a disappointing casting day. He stared at his watch and sighed. 5:45. If the train was not running late, he might just get to see the last 10 minutes of the game. His team was probably losing. It was a bad season, but that was all the more reason they needed his moral support. As he moved to get up, he realized that the actor in front of him had not moved. "I'm sorry," he said again, "but you can leave now. We're looking for something else." "What are you looking for?" With an audible and pointed sigh, Michael slumped back into his seat. The actor winced, and Michael smirked. Though he would never admit it, he got a thrill from the fear of the actors and a kick from the power he got from being a casting director. "Well, for starters, we're looking for the king of the Martian regime." "I'm perfect for the part." Michael sighed again. This happened sometimes, but not often, and he usually had an assistant with him who would kindly escort the stubborn actor outside. But the bubbly and aggressive Terry had the flu, so this was his problem now. "Look, kid," said Michael, "you look like you're about 16, and how can I put this? You're awkward as a giraffe with three legs. I've never seen someone as uncomfortable in his body as you are." The kid shifted his weight, embarrassed. He did bear a startling similarity to a giraffe. His arms and torso looked far too long, as well as his thin neck, and he had to be significantly taller than the 6'2" he claimed on his resume. "A king is probably tall." "I guess," said Michael, "but you're pushing it. Also, you talk like English is a second language. I don't mean you have an accent, but you're emphasizing each syllable like you're discovering speech. It's weird." "If he's a Martian, English is his second language," insisted the actor. "Besides, how do you know how Martians talk?" Michael laughed. "Well, if you're an expert, enlighten me." The actor opened his mouth wide and emitted a high-pitched whine, followed by intense chattering. The sight and sound would have startled any other man, but Michael had seen his share of theatrics in the audition room. "Very interesting," said Michael. "But this time, I'm going to have to believe the writer. The king speaks English. You don't." The kid looked deflated. Michael felt triumphant. He pulled his bag onto his shoulder and stood. "And last of all, but probably most important," said Michael, "you're wearing makeup. I mean, really? I don't care if you're pockmarked or covered in scars. You look like a dying drag queen." "How do you know what a Martian king looks like?" "I know he doesn't look like you." The actor laughed. It was the same high-pitched volume of his nonsense chattering. "Ah, I think I know what you want to see." The kid moved his hands to his face and began to wipe off his makeup. Next, he pulled off his cheeks, followed by his nose, which he popped into his pocket. His hair came off next, revealing a bulbous skull that extended far too much behind him. His eyes he plucked out last. "Do I look more like a Martian king now?" Michael stood frozen, his mouth wide open, terrified. "I'm perfect for the part."
Hello, I'm Shadu Jackson. This is Mirror Image by Peter M. Wood. Sam looked around Dad's cluttered laboratory. Even after becoming a tenured Ivy League physics professor, he still didn't understand Dad's cutting-edge research into quantum physics. Now, with Dad gone after a 3-year battle with cancer, the world would probably stay in the dark. The dusty lab was a paradox, just like Dad. His father had theorized about parallel universes, but had never owned a mobile phone or television. His lab was filled with equipment that was outdated before Sam was born, vacuum tubes and monstrous computers that took up entire walls. His sister, Doris, stepped down the rickety wooden stairs from the back alley entrance. She was dressed to the nines, as if she wanted to impress somebody at the funeral. "I thought I might find you here," she said. "It'll be a shame to auction off Dad's equipment, but that's the only fair thing." His stomach lurched. "Why the hell should we sell the lab? I need time to go through everything. The will says the estate should be split 50-50. She fingered a diamond bracelet. "Of course, if you want, you can have the lab, and I'll take the house." He stared at her wrist. He hadn't seen the bracelet in years, but it was distinctive. "That was Mom's." Doris smiled. "Dad gave it to me last week." "The hell he did. You should have been here, Samuel." He cringed. Everybody called him Sam except Doris. Dad had been floating in and out of dementia for months. Doris had stayed with him the last weeks of his life after not visiting for 10 years. Dad gave her many gifts during this time. His bank account was cleaned out. "The house is worth far more than the lab," Sam snapped. Doris shrugged. "Fine. We'll just sell both and split whatever we get." Sam glared at her. "Don't you have enough money?" "I've got my future to think about." She walked over to a full-length silver mirror. "Why would Dad have this? He never combed his hair or gave a damn what we wore." "How should I know?" Doris leaned casually against a nearby computer. "Careful," Sam said. Doris slapped the machine. "This piece of junk doesn't do anything." But she was wrong. She must have hit a switch. The giant reel-to-reel data tapes clicked as they slowly turned. The mirror glowed. Doris stepped back. Sam noticed a large coax cable running from the computer to the mirror. "What the hell?" He saw the reflections of himself and Doris, but something was wrong. The lab was almost empty. There were no computers. In the mirror, he and Doris wore casual clothes. "It's not a mirror. It's a portal. Look. The lab's clear. It's an alternate world, I think. There are some differences. It's one of the parallel universes that Dad wrote about," Sam said. Doris snorted. "That's ridiculous." Then Sam noticed one thing that was the same in the parallel world. He and Doris were still fighting. The other Doris took off the bracelet and waved it in the face of the alternate Sam. The other Sam grabbed the bracelet and threw it across the room. It slid partway through the portal into their reality. Doris looked at the second bracelet. "So, that's just like my bracelet." "It's exactly the same," Sam said. She reached for it. "Don't touch it," Sam yelled. But his sister ignored him. As she grabbed the bracelet, her twin clutched it from the other side. "It's mine," Doris said to the other self. "Let go, you selfish witch!" But the mirrored Doris would not let go. Sam felt a breeze. The lights flickered. He heard a sound like somebody sucking up the last bit of a milkshake through a straw. And then his sister was slurped through the mirror. Sparks flew out of the computer. The mirror went dark. And with a loud pop, it cracked. The magnetic tape stopped twirling. Smoke rose from the computer. Sam doubted he could get the dimensional portal operational again. He hoped Doris could live with herself.
I'm Judith Jenkins. This story is To Maintain the Balance by Jamie Lackey. Alandra followed the unicorn deeper and deeper into the dying wood. She saw it only as flashes of white in the sunlight that filtered through the brown leaves, but it had to be a unicorn. Unicorns maintained the balance in the world, and her land was dying before its time. They couldn't allow this to continue. Alandra stopped to rest at every tree, her thin chest aching with each breath. Her legs trembled beneath her, and her hands were weak and clumsy, clutching at crumbling bark. Once, she'd won daily foot races against crowds of eager suitors. But one of them had reacted badly to being scorned, and had cursed her, her people, and her homeland. The unicorn could lift her curse and heal her land. She had to catch it, had to plead her case. She pushed away from the tree, careful not to stumble on its twisting roots. She couldn't afford to fall. There was no one left to pick her up. Everyone else was dead or dying, wasting away, drowning on dry land. She thought of her father, gasping and writhing in his sickbed, never once uttering a word of blame.
She should have just married one of her suitors, but none of them had pleased her, and she had no desire to mother babies and stand behind the throne. She swallowed the ache in her throat, coughed against the heaviness in her chest, and forced her feet forward, step by awkward step, struggling from tree to tree, following the sporadic flashes of white. She stumbled into a clearing. The undimmed sunlight stung her eyes. Her knees gave out, and she clutched for something, anything, to keep her from falling. Her fingers brushed soft horsehair, and she clung to it. The unicorn stood next to her, shining in the sunlight like fresh snow. Its horn glowed with a pearly white light, and it smelled like peonies, cinnamon, and lightning. It huffed warm breath against Alandra's cheek. "Hello," Alandra said. Her voice sounded strange in her ears, rusted and wilted and crumbling like everything else she'd once loved. The unicorn stepped back, pulling Alandra forward, and she glimpsed the chair behind it in the shade at the fringes of the clearing. It was delicately carved from thousands of tiny bones and pure white as the unicorn's coat. "What is that?" Alandra asked, but she knew. It was a throne built for long-dead queens to rule from. Once a queen sat down, she never rose again. She ruled with perfect authority over her land until her strength failed. Then her bones became part of the throne, her life part of their legend. The unicorn nudged her toward the throne, but she clung tighter to its mane. "No, wait. I don't understand. I want you to heal me, please. You have to undo this. I never meant for this to happen. It's not my fault. I don't deserve this." The unicorn laid the edge of its horn against her neck. It was flesh, warm and smooth. It pushed against Alandra's throat, forcing her toward the throne. "This isn't what I wanted." Tears streamed down her cheeks. She wrapped both hands around the horn and tried to move it away, but her wasted arms didn't have the strength. The unicorn pushed her back, step by step. The backs of Alandra's thighs hit the throne. She stared into the unicorn's gentle eyes. They were the bright purple of spring crocuses. "Is it really the only way?" Alandra whispered. The unicorn nodded once, slowly. She thought of her people, dying, of her land, dry and wasted. She wondered how much strength she had left. Would it be enough? Alandra sank into her throne. Cold strength flowed through her limbs, and a gale swirled from her throne. It ripped dead leaves from sickened branches, and new buds burst forth. Soft rain fell, and the land greened. Flowers sprouted around the unicorn's feet. It bowed, dipping its head and scraping its horn against the ground. Then it turned and ran, away through the recovering forest. Alandra watched it go. The flowers spread across the clearing. She reached down and picked one, a perfect yellow tulip. She inhaled its scent and closed her eyes. Author's story notes. I have a deep, unabashed love of unicorns in all forms. The Last Unicorn has been one of my favorite movies for as long as I can remember. My husband got me a vinyl unicorn that I could color with permanent markers for Christmas this year, and if I ever get a tattoo, it's going to be a unicorn. I'm so happy to be able to share this story and my love of unicorns with you.
This is Fred Woodward reading Linger by Ken Liu. I am rooted to the ground beneath me, stationary, a statue. The rise and fall of constellations trace broad arcs against my unblinking eyes. The memory of my body in motion sometimes seems unreal. But other memories only become more real with the passage of time. The light, I remember the light. It swept across the fairgrounds like a muslin curtain. On one side, bustle and noise and ecstatic motion. On the other, stillness. "What do you think they want?" she asked. We gazed up at the silver ships in the sky, so close to us that they were like little moons. They had been there for weeks, drifting, hovering, not responding to our hails. She was prettier than her picture. Or perhaps it was the laughter of children and bright carnival lights and the smell of cotton candy and popcorn, which seemed to make everything better than it was. Memories of another fair from years ago came unbidden. "What do you think they want?" Susie asked, pointing to the children congregated around the entrance to an unmarked tent. She licked her cotton candy. "Nothing. They just like the air conditioning," I said. I could see clouds of condensation billowing out of the mouth of the tent. The children luxuriated in them, lingering. But I was nervous. I hoped that she would not eat the cotton candy too fast. "What's this?" she asked, and her face frowned. Her tongue moved around her mouth until she spat out a shiny metal circle into her hand. "Will you?" I asked, my heart pounding louder than the droning air conditioner. But this was not that fair. This woman was not Susie. I didn't really want things to be better. It seemed a betrayal. "Maybe they don't want anything," I said, stalling for time as I tried to find something to say, to fill the hot, sticky air between us. "Maybe they're tired of drifting through space, all that darkness and emptiness and endless movement. They just want to stop for a moment." The light felt like a caress, a gentle breath. Susie's hair from all those years ago, brushing against my chest, my chin, my forehead, as she hovered over me, smiling, and the world fell silent and irrelevant. Funny that I had noticed the quietness before the stillness. I was startled by the missing sounds, the music from the carousel, the shouting attendants at the games, the screams of the teenagers on the plunging Viking ship, before I realized that the painted horses had stopped leaping, the tossed rings had frozen in midair. The Viking ship had been suspended forever at the highest point of its arc. I watched the spinning silvery disks diminish to points of light fainter than the faintest stars and disappear in the dusk, moving on, leaving behind a still moment. My eyes would always remain open, and my lips a permanent O of surprise. "Stop for a moment," she asked. A wave of dark memories washed over me. The smell of medicine, the beeping machines, the tubes in Susie, around her, tying her down, her gaunt, pale face, with eyes that would never again open. "This was a mistake," I blurted. She did not stare at me, for which I was grateful. "You miss her," she said. "Yes," I said. "I'm sorry. I thought I was ready, but moving on is overrated," she said. She is behind me and to the left, just outside the edge of my peripheral vision. I imagine us, the entire human race, frozen in place like mannequins in a diorama, like pinned butterflies under a display case. Did the aliens want to preserve us in this frozen state, a bubble in the stream of time, specimens warded from change? As the sun sinks in the sky, her shadow stretches across my field of vision until its elongated head touches the base of the Ferris wheel and it merges into the night. I've tried to picture her in my mind 100, 1,000, 10,000 times, but retracing the patterns of memory has only made them lose fidelity, and with each reimagining I erase a little more of her, until her face is a blank canvas onto which I have projected the features of my desire. As I stand, eyes wide open, the stars spinning slowly over my head, I dream of her, of our frozen date, of what might have been. I fall in love with her. I fall out of love. I miss her. I recreate her and fall in love again. Sometimes I also dream of Susie, and there is no longer guilt in the memories. Goodbye, I say. Susie says nothing. The machines have been removed from her, her face a mask. She does not need to tell me to let go. She does not need to tell me to forget her. The changing of the seasons causes the sun's path to migrate across the sky, and the tip of her shadow slowly shifts, drifts, tracing out a great infinity symbol, like the tip of a sundial, each and every year. Linger, she said. I listened. Behind me, the voices of the teenagers on the Viking ship rise to a crescendo. Life is too short to keep on forgetting. It's good to try to hold on to what you love for as long as you can. Forget about being healthy. Ignore the shrinks. And that was when I thought I could begin to love again. How many years has it been? How many decades, centuries, millennia? The Ferris wheel rusts, decays, collapses like a fading flower. Paint melts, drips from the horses on the carousel. I start to sink into the muddy ground as the trees rise around me, returning the fairgrounds to jungle. I am on the cusp of love, of never letting go.
We've run out of time for today's episode of Sci-Fi. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Kurt Benrood, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Sci-Fi is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.